Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today for a change, I'm flying solo as a single host. But as always, whenever we get to do these episodes, we always bring a good guest or an interesting guest or a cool guest. And today's no exception. So my guest today is a watch collector, a really interesting guy from the other side of the world. We met through Instagram. We've actually been chatting for a little while through Instagram, through comments and things, but this is the first time I actually get to meet this person and chat in person. So you as listeners will find out everything about it probably at the same time that I will. But anyway, this should be a really, really cool conversation. So his name is Niels. Hey, Niels, welcome to Fifth Wrist Radio. Great to have you.
Thank you, Roman. As I just attested to a couple of minutes ago, I'm an avid listener of your show, and it's a great honor to be on.
Look, the honor is always ours. As I said, kind of the way this conversation came up for listeners, you and I have been chatting for a while. We seem to like very similar watches. As I'm sure we'll get to talk about your collection and kind of the stuff that you're into is very much stuff I'm into. So we've been kind of having these back and forward conversations that I think at one point I said, like, oh, we should get you on the show. So the honor is always very much ours. What I like to see of these things, I got into this kind of the horology stuff, when particularly the podcast. It's all for me, it's really all about the people, because the people make this stuff interesting. So I'm super stoked to meet you and get to talk to you. So this is awesome. Really looking forward to it.
Likewise.
Well, we don't have a strict structure, but we might as well get into a little bit of a structure of the show. So we usually start with a wrist check, a drink check, and a location check. You are the guest. So you're the star of the show, I should say, not just a guest. You are the reason we are here. So maybe let's start with you. So give us a drink, location, and a wrist decoration.
Yeah, sure. Let me start with the wrist.
Most important.
Inspired by, I actually came around to this brand from another Fifth Wrist podcast. I think it was Mike Stufler on Defining Time.
I know which watch this is going to be. I have a guess? Because I don't. We haven't practiced this. Is this the Decla?
It is.
Ah, yeah. Score.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome.
I haven't been wearing this for a little while, and actually took it out yesterday, and I thought it was fitting to this show. It's a lovely watch, ruthenium dial, white gold hands. Decla is a small company, two Ukrainian cousins in the middle of the Black Forest, not in the middle of the Black Forest, near the Black Forest in Stuttgart. Creating watches to the liking of the owner, and this one features awesome. A fully hand engraved 6498, and it's a lovely watch.
Beautifully done.
I am double parked with a glass of sparkling water, and I thought it would be fitting for me to find some Australian wine and just embrace my what should we say? My
your
new
inner Aussie
joblessness.
Yeah. Oh goodness! Start, right, okay.
And start day drinking. a nice glass of Australian white wine just before I pick up the kids.
Nothing says inner Aussie like day drinking before picking up children. I mean, I think the rest of the Australian contingent really salutes you there.
And
location, give us, where are you? Where are you based?
I'm on Amager. It's still Copenhagen, but it's there's a 10-15 minute bike ride to the middle of Copenhagen. But that's my location check, and the time is about 2:00.
Beautiful. Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Lovely call out to Decla in a previous episode. That's the one, I think. Shout out to Klaus at Tapir FFM and Mike, who did that episode a little while ago. And Decla is a really, really cool brand, that kind of very classical German kind of chronometer style dials. I'm a big fan. Plus the options they have of like customizing stuff at a really affordable, if we can say, price bracket. It's really cool. Really, really cool stuff. Lots to love. Lots to love and, there.
And there's more customization than they offer on the website. It's just, call them up, write them an email. There's a lot more to be done if you want.
Yeah, no, look, my wife's not here. I've been looking at Decla for a while. It's one of those things where you kind of go like, how far, it's the same problem I have with like Oxen Junior. Like if I start really playing with it, it's really hard to put away. So I'm like, sometimes it's better not to look. Because like if I know exactly what they customize, like it's too dangerous to tiptoe into territory. Oh, but that's cool. I forgot about the Ukrainian cousin stuff. I mean, my background, I'm from Ukraine originally. So that always, any Ukrainian connection sings to me it is. Very nice. Beautiful choice for the podcast. All right, I do my bit. So location-wise, I'm in Melbourne, Australia. I haven't moved for a little while. Trying to organize some trips away this year and towards the end of the year, maybe to the US. So stay tuned. But for now, I'm very much in Melbourne, Australia. Drink-wise, I'm also like you, I'm double parked and also a sensible choice and a not so sensible choice. I mean, so the time is it's just after 10 o'clock in the evening. So I've got a cup of tea here because I was putting my son to bed. So I've got a cup of tea here. And then it's double parked with a bottle of gin because I'm sure that will come out. And hopefully people can hear that. That's Four Pillars. That's the Australian gin that I'm enjoying at the moment. So that's me. And in terms of watches, once again, I was trying to figure out thematically what would work for this podcast. Ideally, I don't have a Danish watch. I mean, I would love a Danish. The Danish watch that haunts my dreams is a Christian Lass. I'm not sure that's going to happen for a little while, unfortunately, or ever, but it's an awesome watch. And shout out to Christian and Hannah, both friends of the podcast and really, really good people. But the watch I've got with me is my Maxim Sushkov. And that's a watch that you and I share together. And this would possibly be the first podcast that two of the people on the podcast have Maxim's watches. Maxim Sushkov's, of course, a maker out of St. Petersburg. So I know you've got yours, and yours is pretty awesome as well. So I thought that would connect us quite nicely in that universe. And shout out to Maxim. I was having a chat with him today. Awesome guy based in St. Petersburg. Yeah, so that's me.
I was contemplating wearing that as well, but unfortunately I can't because Max is actually fixing mine up as we speak. So,
all right. So yours is back home, getting some love. Very cool.
Exactly.
You getting any modifications done or just needed a bit of technical stuff? If you want to share, that is.
Yeah, sure. It was just the cap for the minute hand that fell off. So
that's right. I remember you were saying
that's the only thing. But just a couple of days ago, he sent me a picture that he totally remodeled the minute hand to have a really nice bevel where it attached to the stem, and he actually redesigned the hour hand as well to fit a little better with the index. So and we didn't talk about it at all. He just sent me a couple of things. I did this and this. So
I was gonna, one of my things to talk to you about is kind of the theme of your collecting. It was a question I had further down, but that to me is the most exciting part. So what I tend to collect are younger and newer makers, particularly in their kind of first series or second series of watches, because I think that's where they're at their most creative and they're trying things, and sometimes things don't work, but they're always tinkering and improving. To me, that's kind of the exciting bit. Mm-hmm. So kind of hearing your story of like, oh, this bit didn't quite work, I send it to them, and instead of just doing a quick fix, like he's redesigned, he's actually taken the time and kind of improved it, and it's evolved. And when you get it back, it's like, it's just, to me, that's so exciting. That's like, that's the best. It's the best.
Yeah. Me as well. I was just sitting, watching some Le Mans over the weekend, and then just a message popped up, and
The best. No, it's tribute to Maxim. It's a great dude. Anyone's listening here, definitely check out his Instagram, and definitely get in touch. He's very responsive, young guy working on his own, doing some really cool things. Highly recommended. He's now in his sort of second series of watches, the first one being that kind of Ouroboros style jump hour watch that sold out, but now he's kind of doing the classical sort of 6498 reworked movement, but beautifully, like sort of hand skeletonized movement decorated. But then the dial options, you could just about kind of go to town. Like the stuff he made for me was, he made sort of this font for numerals that he made, all the hour minutes, like hour indicators different. Like just awesome. Like just Piaget dial. He's good dude. Highly, highly recommended. All right. Well, look, Niels, I reckon probably a good place for people who don't know you. I mean, you could be world famous in Copenhagen. I don't know. But for people who are listening who don't know you, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of how you got into watches, how you got into this craziness, how you caught this disease.
Yeah. I guess it's something that's been that been with me for a long time. I remember when I was a small kid, my dad had a Psychokinetic watch, which
nice.
He still has it. He doesn't wear it as much anymore, but had like a power reserve indicator in the jumping second, it was a quartz watch, so you could press a button and then it would on the dial it would display how much battery was saved in the movement, and I could just sit for hours, and at least that's how I remember it, and press that watch and see the second hand line up and tell you how much power reserve was in the watch, my mother used to go to Asia a lot for work, and every time she returned home, she would always have something for me, maybe a couple of records and a watch. It would say Porsche on the dial, or there would be a skeleton riding a Harley Davidson or something for a 10-year-old.
Perfect.
Yeah, So I had a little box in my room filled with the cheap Chinese watches, which I wore, and they stopped working the next month or whatever.
Yeah, of course.
So I guess that's where it sort of started. But in my 20s, I sort of dabbled and looked at watches here and there, but when I turned 30, my wife gave me a vintage Tissot.
Interesting.
Yeah,
and good choice. Great choice.
I picked it out myself, as I remember. But from then on, it just snowballed. With the Speedmasters and vintage Longines, some Rolex, some Tudor, some just all over the board. And then eventually you end up looking at stuff that at some point for me I thought that there was a flock mentality. Every time you go to a meetup, everybody would wear the same two watches, and in the watch roll there would be three or four of the same, maybe with a different dial color or another bezel or whatever.
Of course.
I kind of grew tired of that whole setup. So I started looking around for things that that I thought would be at least to me more interesting. And I guess that's how you end up with a Suskov, a Dekla, and a Philippe Pikulik in your watch box instead of a GMT Master Master.
Totally. And we should absolutely talk about that, the Pikulik watch as well, because that's a pretty cool piece as well. So over what distance of time did you go? Like, how long did it take you for go mainstream to the Philippe Pikulik? Like, we're talking 5 years, 10 years.
Maybe I would say six.
Oh wow,
six or 7 years. I mean, watches really started off for me when I turned 30, I'm turning 40 this year. So
wow.
And I think it was maybe 3 years ago. I kind of sold out most of my. what you would say,
mainstream stuff,
old collection.
Right.
Old collection. I still have I have a Tudor in my collection, and I'm still a sucker for Psycho's Marine Master and all that. I wouldn't say that I've totally abandoned everything that you would that you can buy in Walmart. That's
sure.
But sure. But I think you get the gist of it. So but at least for me, it's exciting to find and enjoy something that you won't see on every corner, at least.
Oh yeah, absolutely, and I can absolutely relate. And looking like listening to your story, that makes perfect sense to me, because that sort of, you know, mirrors to some way how I got into the indie stuff as well. But the speed at which you kind of, we won't say matured, but found your niche now is really quick. I mean, that's pretty cool. That is very, very cool. And what informed your pursuit of, let's say, the indie stuff? Is it Instagram? Is that other collectors? Like, how did you, what was your path towards those esoteric kind of watches? Is it self drive? Yeah. Okay.
I would say it's a mix of things. I've always been, I've played a lot of music, and I've played death metal and that right. branch of stuff, and also been doing some more jazzy stuff. And I've always been in the outliers of
right.
So I think I have a natural progression towards stuff that's should we say out of the ordinary. But of course you get inspired by of course there's Instagram. You can curate your feed to should we say see more of what you find exciting, and of course interactions with other collectors, listening to podcasts such as your own. And I think I just needed, should we say, like a kick in the butt to get started with all the more, what you would say, independent stuff.
Sure.
I've had long and great talks with you mentioned Christian Lass before.
Yes.
Peter, who bought his first piece.
Yeah. Peter's such a great guy.
He's a great friend of mine. He lives 2 kilometers that way.
Oh, and, say hello. Legend. Yeah. Legend.
So certainly seeing a lot of Peter's pieces that he's handled through his journey also inspired me, and lots of other collectors. So of course that's had an impact as well. I think there's always been a natural what you would say, like flame in me to do something that maybe others don't. Yeah.
Oh, very cool. So as you're heading into your 40s, and I'm just on the other side of 40, so, you know, it's not as bad as people say. 40 is fine. that's what I tell myself that. Is there a significant timepiece that's kind of looming on the horizon to celebrate the 40? Sorry, I'm going in with personal questions now.
Yep.
You know.
Actually not.
Excellent. We can start to suggest a few then. That's fine.
It's fine. No. I'm just I'm actually at a place now where I think I need to trim down the collection maybe a little bit.
Oh yes.
Gotcha. So.
No, that's all good. Yeah.
Not for now.
Yeah, because the other question I often ask when I talk to collectors. And it's a question that I hate when people ask me. They go like, at what stage of the collection are you? Are you kind of, are you growing? Are you consolidating? Or are you shrinking? And I hate when people ask me that question. So that's why I'm asking you that question. What do you reckon? Are you still, and the idea is, you know, if you're growing, you're still in the, I need to sample more and more and more. I'm still consolidating. You're like, I've got enough. I need to sell maybe down. I need to sell 3 to buy 1. Mm. And Trinky, you're like, no, I have way too much. I just need to start shedding and getting manageable.
It will always, I think for me, trimming down always means scaling up in a way, right?
That's why you and I are so in sync. This is like spooky. This is crazy. Yeah.
So it would for me it would probably be selling two or three pieces and just clearing out the horizon on what to bring in next, because there's always the next one, right?
But, yeah, there's a list. Are you an organized collector with a list of wish list?
I'm not organized in any form, shape, or way.
Oh, you're a free spirit, shall we say?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. No, it's really you're into heavy metal. Like, I'm thinking if you can afford a Dan Spitz is the way to go. Like, ex guitarist of Anthrax, who's now making these amazing handmade watches on his own. Like, that would be like thematic dream. But not that I'm pushing you towards it. I'm just floating it out there. Floating it out there.
Yeah, exactly. That would make sense.
He's a cool dude. But you've got Christian Lass as well, on very close to you. You know, save on the import taxes as well. So there's some financial reasons to stay local.
I actually have a funny Christian Lass anecdote involving my wife, and it's not as
everyone got worried for like a split second.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Stand down.
No, just a short while ago I sold my Ming 1709 to Hannah.
Yep. Okay. Christian's oh really wife. Oh yeah, wow yeah. Cool.
And Christian and Hannah and the rest of the family, the two boys, were coming to Zealand to go to a museum, so they could just stop by for a cup of coffee and pick up the watch and so on and so forth. And I just told my wife that they were coming by and picking a watch, and that was it. I didn't tell her the rest of the story or who Christian is and sure. so on and so forth. So while Hannah and I were chatting and about the Ming, and I was showing her something about with the box and with the watch and so on and so forth, my wife is probably the best small talker I know.
Right. But
she opposed Christian, and just her first question to Christian was, are you into watches as well?
Oh, bless. That's awesome. That's so funny.
That's great. A really, that's awesome. Really funny moment. Yeah.
That's great. No, look, there is always something really nice, I think, when normal people, and I use inverted, but normal people who are just regular people who, you know, who are sane, not crazy people like us, sort of, yeah, we think we build these gods in a very small universe, like with the Philippe Dufours, the Christian Lasses, the Roger Smiths, we build them up as these colossuses of things, whereas they're just normal people, right? And like people outside of this universe go, yeah, no, I'm just chatting. You seem nice. You're like, do you know who you were talking to?
Yeah.
That's so funny. It's always, I love stories like that. Yeah, I love stories like that. Because your wife's not into watches, I'm guessing, right? Or your partner?
She is not. Actually, right. Today she sent me her first wrist shot ever.
Oh, bless! Oh, she's learning. Excellent.
Yeah. I bought her as a push present. I bought her a watch this weekend. So she sent me.
Aren't you nice?
Yeah. So she sent me a wrist shot today. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's really nice. I mean, that's very nice, but also very strategic. If you get your wife into watches, you double the number of wrists in the family, so you kind of go, well, I'm not buying this for you. I'm not buying this for me. I saw this.
Yeah,
it's a Panerai. It's 44 mil, but on your wrist, I reckon we could both wear it or something. So that's strategic. I like your thinking. I like your thinking. No, I tried that with my wife. She's really not into watches at all. My wife wears a Garmin on one wrist and a Whoop on the other. Whoop's like a fitness device thing. So my wife double wrists regularly, but with the wrong type of watches. So it has caused some strain in the family, but we're working through it with a counselor. It's fine. It's fine. It's really fine. No, it's really cool.
I hope you pull through.
Well, look, we've got hope. I mean, well, I do as well, because I really don't want to split my collection in half for a divorce. That would be very traumatic. So I think we have to preserve the marriage for the sake of my watch collection. I'm not prepared to part halfway. No, we're totally fine. And if she's listening to this, which she won't be, but if she is, you know, love you, honey. You're the best. but that's really cool. What I thought is I was looking through your Instagram feed, kind of trying to put like a logical kind of framework on your collection. Not that you have to have one, but I was trying to kind of classify, like get a theme. And I kind of, so I was looking stuff. You get like Philippa Pikulic, Dekla, you got like a Damasco, there's a Lenga and Zuna. So I was sort of thinking, no, maybe sort of cool German, indie German watches. And then I kind of found another page, which was like Breguet 5907, kind of neo-vintage time only. There's like a Breguet Tradition, which is like a killer piece, like a totally on my dream list. Then like a Vacheron, let's see, there's 3110. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, all right, maybe Swiss kind of classic, maybe slightly oddball, but classic. And then I kind of zig back to like Sushkov, Hodinkee Bierkes, they get a Ming, like at a bunch of Seikos and like in a Grand Seiko. I'm like, all right, hang on. There's no theme here. Also, obviously, I'm omitting the Rolex Submariner. We don't talk about that rubbish here. But, you know, is it like, it's really cool. Like, is there a theme or is it just kind of you go with whatever catches the eye? Is what I'm going to get at.
First of all, there's no Rolex in the collection.
Oh, good. Excellent. No, see? Well, we have to vet you before you come on the show. Brilliant. That's good. Yeah. Okay, good. Thank God for that.
Yeah,
I don't
have
to cut this bit out now. Good. Excellent. Nope. Less editing. Nope.
I used to own the Lange. I used to own a Saxonia Thin.
Yes, that's the one I saw. Yeah.
That one is gone. The Breguet 5907 is that's mine.
I like it. That's a really nice watch. Yeah, it's a really nice watch.
Really is. And I think I would say if there's a theme for the collection now, it would be as you mentioned before, trying to find out young independent guys.
Right.
Okay. Going forward, and then the new vintage stuff. I'm actually really getting into that again.
So
I could foresee maybe changing out the Vacheron for maybe another triple calendar, but from the 90s in the precious 90s. Metal.
Oh, yeah. I was trying to figure out like because like I talked to a lot of guys. For some reason, mostly guys. Who are sort of in our age bracket. I'm going to slightly drag your age bracket up towards kind of that late 30s, early 40s. You're obviously in the early late 30s, shall we say. Near vintage is very strong now. So because in my head, near vintage is kind of late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But most people kind of go with that sort of 95, the kind of the Daniel Roth Breguet style.
Mm-hmm.
To maybe Alain Silberstein, to sort of the Breguet stuff that you've got, which I also really like. But yeah, like I think it's a very interesting, quite hot market particularly at the moment. And I always try to figure out why that is, and I don't know whether it's the dealers. There's enough stock for the dealers to trade and push the prices up, or whether it's a bunch of nostalgia for guys who have just got disposable income now, who are in their kind of mid-30s, late 30s, early 40s, hankering back to watches they liked 25 years ago when they were 15 and couldn't afford them. I'm trying to understand where that's going. Like Icepod is another kind of brand that sort of fits in that 90s sort of bracket. That's really, yeah, okay.
I'm sure that the outlets like A Collected Man and in the what you were saying the slipstream of that you've got someone like Watch Brothers London pushing these these new vintage pieces and I just think also there's a bit of a trend for smaller case sizes and I just think it's just a hot pocket for design and for a more classical what you would say both style size and as you mentioned maybe prices are rising but they're still compared to whatever you if you're going to buy a new Breguet if you're lucky, a 5907 won't set you back just half as much as a Patek Calatrava, and
oh, for sure.
in my mind, you actually have more of a watch there. There's the watchmaking pedigree is certainly, should we say, unparalleled with the Breguet, right? And you have the dial, the quality of the dials, it's perfect. The hands, and if you find something with a see-through case pack, you get that element as well. For me, it's still just a lot of value compared to, a lot of other things. Yeah, exactly. A lot of other stuff in the market. So for me, it's just a kind of a hot pocket for value, but also something that represents. It's a bit more timeless in my mind than a 39 or 40 millimeter white gold Calatrava. That's because if you look at Calatravas like they were made in what you were saying in olden times and decades ago, and for decades it were 33, 34 millimeters. The Breguet is 34 millimeters and it's still perfect.
Look, I've owned a couple. There's a particular reference from that similar era that I've owned, I think, twice, which is a 3490, which is a sort of tonneau-shaped one, similar sort of sub-dial. It's in yoga, but sort of a tonneau shape. But yeah, and I've owned it twice now. And one thing that's when the build quality is just so much better is I think. Yeah. In that kind of mid-90s, late-90s, they were made in smaller quantities as well. So they were made – there's definitely a much more of a luxury feel to them, at least maybe to me. Mm-hmm. And once again, maybe I'm kind of – those watches are wrapped up in nostalgia for me because when they just came out, they were far beyond what I could afford anyway. So maybe they were aspirational then. But I kind of agree with you that the feel is better. They seemed like they were made with more care. Whereas now it's more of a mass-produced luxury, so it's less special, maybe. But who knows? But yeah,
I totally agree. I totally agree. I mean, putting a loop to the dial and the hands of a Breguet and doing that exact same thing to almost every Calatrava I can think of, I can assure you who takes my vote.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. We better stop talking about them because I can feel the price rising just as we speak. They're terrible watches. They're mechanically, they're terrible people. If you're listening to it, buy new. No, that's fine. And are you more of a dress watch guy, tool watch guy? What's your, are you a bit of everything? Because certainly for me, I'm very much more in the dressier watch category. I buy... tool watches. I have no need for tool watches after I get a Seamaster or something. I'm like, I'm done. Don't need more.
Yeah, but totally. It's the same for me. I have a couple of, should we say, tool watches, and admittedly, they're practical during the day with the 3-year-old. I'm certainly more prone towards a dressier. I'm not a big fan of the term dress watch because I rarely dress up. Breguet, the Breguet style and leather straps and that would be where I'm looking.
You lean more towards Breguet than Panerai on the pantheon of archetypes of watches, right? Gotcha. And. Yeah. Yeah. Smaller cases is kind of where you're at, like sort of under 36 mil kind of thing. Yeah, okay.
I think 38 is probably the sweet spot for me. I recently bought a Harbring Chrono Felix.
And, yes, you know, I was going to ask you about that.
That 38.5 millimeters, that's the exact same size as the Philippe Pikulik, by the way. But you know, that's the sweet spot. So 38, 39. But certainly smaller is fine by me.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, the Harbring's interesting. Lots of love in the fifth wrist crew, Hubring gets a lot of play, and shout out to Anthony, a defining time. It wouldn't be a podcast, it wouldn't be a fifth wrist production without slipping Hubring in for Anthony, or Oxen Jr. for Klaus. We need to tick those things off. But both of those brands, they're fantastic. But it's really cool. Really, really cool. So talk to me about one of the things I want to talk to you about. So you've got a couple of really fantastic handcrafted kind of piece unique watches, the Philippa Pikulic watch. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested about. Maybe tell us a little bit about that. He's a maker that I suspect not a lot of people know. He has been becoming more popular and all speed to him. Maybe tell us a little bit about how you got to know him and kind of how your watch came about.
Yeah, sure.
That was a cool, cool piece.
I really, this is totally honest. I can't remember how I sort of got nudged toward him, but at that point he had made some skeletonized chronographs that was present on his website. I think he actually took those pictures down and he's focused on his sort of core collection now.
Yeah.
Those weren't particular to my liking, but he had just started making, I think maybe the first two pieces of his Sternhimmel. And I saw that, and I saw what he did to the movement, how he made the hands and so on. And I talked to him, and he at that time, and people listening to back to this now will think I'm joking, but at that time the starting price for Sternhimmel was 900 euros.
Yes.
And I think it's 48 now or something. And the finishing is a lot better now. And other stuff, but I looked at it and just thought this is basically stupid. That why aren't people just falling over each other to buy this? And I think at that time he maybe had like 1,800 followers on Instagram or something. And I guess I haven't checked.
You caught them at the right time. That's
exactly.
You were there. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
Nice.
I contacted him and asked him if there was any possibility to make a smaller case and if we could jam a little around on about the dial and so on. And he actually just started thinking about making a smaller case, and we, along with Søren, my friend, we ordered three pieces. If you look at his collection now, I talked to Philippe last week. Actually, I forgot to ask him, in some way, it seems like our piece kind of laid the foundation for what was to come. Because I actually had a lot of people asking me how I got a Harrison so quickly, and I was like, it's not a Harrison. This is actually my own design.
Yeah. I was here before you guys, but yeah. But glad you like it. Nice.
We put an order in October of what's that? That would be 2021, and. We got it exactly 1 year after, actually.
Cool.
And Philippe was very nice to fly in and deliver the watches in person.
Oh, that's even better. That's magic.
Yeah, yeah. It was that was a fantastic. He actually missed the first flight of the day, and I was a bit worried. That night was going to be spoiled, but luckily he could catch another flight, and he was able to make the delivery. And it was just such a fantastic process with Philippe, video calls and drawings back and forth, and design of the bridges and so on. It's a truly fulfilling experience to take part in the design process it makes the watch so much more valuable to do, at least for me, than something you either buy secondhand or whatever. You can buy at your local AD, and Yeah, I'm just really happy that that we had the opportunity to get those pieces made, and also that we kind of caught up with him before he before Hodinkee did. Let's say that.
Yes, so, well, yes, yeah. That's the dream. Yeah. That's really cool. I mean, that story essentially for me is like that's the bit that's the most enjoyable. And that I always, when people ask me, like, what's the most exciting thing about watches? For me, it's actually seeing makers start out and, like, when your order makes a difference, where they've got an idea, but they're just starting out and you show interest, you show support. And the fact that you and your friends ordered one or two or three watches at that point made a material difference. To Philippe, I would imagine, either gave him confidence to proceed that his stuff was going to be thingy, or money to buy another machine or buy a Schoblin lathe or something like that. And watching that process happen is really, really cool, because now, you know, all speed to him, and he's got a good established order. He's good for the next couple of years. He's got orders in. He's established, but your watches will always be special, even if they're not finished as well as the work he's doing now, because he would have progressed. It's just, yeah, those early pieces are special just for that very reason. There's such a timestamp from when those makers were early days, for sure. So, so cool.
He was actually, he told us that as well, and during the dinner, he was actually really, really close to just shutting down, because he had the feeling of people aren't into this and they aren't buying it and so on.
Absolutely.
And it was his wife who actually just said, make some cheap pieces, sell them as cheap as you can. And he was like, as he told his wife, I mean, you can't make watches cheap.
Yes.
But she said, make something too cheap and then the customers will come. And so...
Yeah. Oh, look.
Yeah. So that's what he did. And by that, word spread. And and now he's totally booked for I don't know booked how long.
Good luck to him, and we wish him all the best. Absolutely. Like, and that, like, I've had this conversation probably a few times on the podcast, definitely with lots of people off the podcast. There, at least in my mind, there's two ways new watchmakers seem to enter the independent watch space. Either they come in with a watch that's really well done, but it's like $50,000 or $40,000. Or they come in with a watch that's significantly underpriced for what is different. It's like $3,000, where it really should be $10,000, right? And the idea is the first series tends to sell out really quickly if the maker's good. But then the second series is like five times the price. It's a bit like the Philippe, right? The first one's 900 euros. And it's like, it's stupid that it's 900 euros. It should never have been 900 euros. But it was like, he's making a huge loss on it with the hope that it will find a market and it will boost the collectors, and the next series will be $5,000. Or Pascal Caillon was another, was the ideal kind of thing for that. The first watch is a 5.5. It takes him 5 years to do them because there's so much handcraft in it. Yeah. The next series is like 35,000 or whatever they are now. But he's prepared the market, because they're like, oh, he can deliver on time. The watches are crazy, really hot. Really worthwhile. The guys who start out really high, like 40,000, 50,000, it's a much harder thing to shift units. And I would imagine the fail rate for those makers is the fail rate in terms of like their company succeeding would be really hard. Unless you're like an established name, like a Christian Lass, for example, where he's worked with the Annie Halter. He was a watchmaker at Patek Museum for 10 years. He's kind of in the kitchen. I've got friends who work in restaurants. He's made his bones. Like he's worked under really good chefs. He's going to deliver, right? So it's kind of, but I see quite a few new brands struggle. New guys should make amazing watches, but they're like 50, 60, 70 K. And you kind of go, well, I can't afford that. And if you could sell enough, but that's a huge leap of faith. To also to give half of that to a new person you've never met before, to go, there's $40,000, and when it's ready, I'll pay you the other 40. Like, that must be so hard.
And I think you're right. Yeah, there's also I mean, as soon as you put something out or say that you're going to put something out for whatever the price may be, let's say it's 30-40k, and you start building up the expectations from day one, right? And when you start out low and the first the first emotion that your audience, customer, whatever it may be, will have, is like, this is too good to be true.
Yeah. Yes.
Then coming forward, I think you've paved an easier path for yourself than if you need to convince people on how good you are and how valuable your stuff may be, then you're setting sail in something that might be difficult to sail in, to use a picturesque language.
Yeah. And it's not. And that's not us, well, at least me. It's not my intention ever to sort of denigrate or mark down somebody's work, to say, if you're a young watchmaker and you make some amazing product, yeah, it's worth, if you put in 5,000 hours or 2,000 hours into a watch, yeah, like, it's worth a lot more in your labor to do it. Unfortunately, it's a very hard thing to translate that into a $25 an hour for your labor. It should be a $50,000 watch. That's not, unfortunately, at least in my mind, that's a very hard mathematics to complete for a new maker. Unless you do something revolutionary, but very few new makers genuinely do something really crazy revolutionary, because it's very hard. So they kind of do a time only, beautifully finished classical watch. This tends to be the thing. Like, it's beautifully finished, beautifully made. You're like, yeah, but it's very classic. So no, but it does sound like you caught Philippe just at the right moment. And yeah, I'm glad you found him, and I'm glad he found you, because it sounds like it made a difference just at the right time, which is awesome. That's like the best way to support like a young maker, like a young creator. Yeah. Is there somebody you're looking at now? Like, is there somebody that you're thinking about as somebody you're watching closely as like a new maker on the block?
Good question.
Sorry, I put you on the spot.
yeah, you really did.
Sorry about that.
There's a couple, I think, but most of them, I can't really exactly remember the names now. But most of them are actually you've got a lot of young talent coming out of from the watchmaking schools in France, debuting lots of the school pieces. And I'm like, we've already seen Thierry Offray, what he's doing. I think the next generation of young guys coming out will be mind blowing. I think there's just a lot of creativity in also in the classical watchmaking right now, and there's a kind of a trend of doing high horology and complications and trying to democratize them a little bit. Look at the Belcanto from Christopher Ward. All of these collaborations between all of the makers. Christopher Ward had Armin Strom do all the mechanics for the Belcanto, and I think there's a shift in the way that high horology, as we know it, was only for reserved for these and such price brackets.
Sure.
And I think in the coming years we're going to see a big shift in that, and that's something that really excites me, and can't wait to see what's coming. I think everybody was shocked by the Belcanto, myself included. I haven't got my eyes on something in particular, but I think there's really exciting stuff in the pipeline.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think there's a combination of a couple of things, because I agree with you. There's some amazing talent coming out, just actually coming out from every continent. There's some really cool guys doing stuff in Europe. But there were always really cool stuff coming out of Europe. But now there's guys in China There's guys in Taiwan, particularly my limitation, I find there's lots of talent. I don't speak the language, right? Particularly in China, you know, a lot of those guys don't speak English. So a lot of their Instagram stuff is not in English. So it's harder to, but if you dig into that, if you speak the language, there's some really crazy stuff coming out. Like, I think there is kind of a confluence of a couple of things. So one is, I agree with you, like there's a lot of creativity, and I think the students now, watchmaking students now, look at guys like Theo Fret or Comte or Gail Pyramid Badat. They look at them and go, well, if those guys can do it, there is a receptive market. If I have a crazy idea, maybe I'll succeed as well. So they're encouraged to be creative because they know there's a potential market waiting to be appreciated. And the other thing I think is really helpful is the kind of the CAD technology is becoming much more accessible as well. You don't have to, the programs don't cost as much. You can learn how to do it. There's everything from YouTube videos to online courses. You can pick up that kind of the design stuff is no longer this. You don't have to go through Renault Papi to get somebody to design, like a specialist bureau to design a movement. You're like, that sort of knowledge is democratized. The thing I find really interesting is there's lots of whispers about AI, using AI to kind of brainstorm ideas for watch design. And I'm sure that's kind of happening already. Like, I'm
probably,
you know, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, all of these things are some kind of feeding into this kind of frenzy. The one word of caution that I would sort of use, and I actually was having a conversation with a collector today, I sort of said, there's never been more watches. There's never been more people trying to sell your watch, trying to sell you an independent watch. This like every day, there's always new, and everything is in render form. Like, you can see amazing drawings and renders. Like, there's never been more of those available. And I'm like, yeah, there is always, the more bubbles and froth there is, the more there's opportunities for unscrupulous makers to overpromise and never deliver. Then there's sort of, there are some vague echoes of like the early 2010s where we had these similar thing of just before the financial crisis, and also just after, there was a whole bunch of people with a lot of money, and these indie watch brands kept popping up with amazing designs, and they would just take deposits and just would just disappear. And like, it's one of those things, you're like, I'm really happy for the indie market, for the indie creators to be super, super optimistic. But I sometimes think there's also, amongst the amazing stuff, there's also quite a lot of bullshit just floating through. And it's becoming sometimes hard to distinguish who is who, sort of thing.
But
it is what it is. I mean, it's always been like that, I suspect. It's just, yeah, the more excitement there is, people get, what I think happens is if there is a lot of great makers doing stuff at $50,000, there'll be more people making, $20,000, and there'll be even more people offering you in the $10,000, and it kind of trickles down all the way to Kickstarter brands, which sell you an Erwerk lookalike watch for like $1,500, and you go, well, how? It's just, that's really interesting. It'd be like, you can't be, it just cannot be sensible. So, but look, all speed to the indie makers. If you make it, they will come. There's enough people out there looking at stuff now, but you just hope it's sustainable and ethically done is kind of all I want to know.
Yeah, no, and also I said but that conjecture would, what you need to be aware of as someone coming up, and is it pricing stuff right and taking in. I know for a fact that Philippe also was lucky enough to get a lot of orders, but also a lot of orders for the stuff that wasn't priced right for a certain amount of time,
and he
immediately had to increase his prices, obviously makes sense, and do it again. But you as a young maker, you mentioned it before, and a guest and co-host of your podcast before, Ruben Scoots. That's what he did with his first series as well. He priced them exceptionally well, and then the next series, you just need to have like a clear outlook and maybe even roadmap when things started rolling, because you can also get caught in being stuck with a cheap product that you have to make a lot of.
And Ruben's a great example. So he's a great guy out of Canberra here in Australia. I think the other trick is the trick I would imagine for a maker is you've got to know your limits, because if you want to work on your own, but all of a sudden you've got 150 watches on order, mm-hmm. that's you essentially. That's your time for the next 10 years, unless you get additional watchmakers. But as soon as you start getting additional watchmakers, the story of I'm just a single watchmaker doing these things on my own, if that's the romance people who ordered watches bought into, if that's the story people bought into, it's a really tricky balance, right? Because if that's the bit you made you special, all of a sudden, if you have to have more people, like that takes that story away. So you're right. You're exactly right. I think you've got to know how much do I want to grow and what's sustainable for the work that I want to do and the story that I want to tell. So, yeah, no, it's a tricky thing. I'm really glad I'm not a maker. I can do anything. So I'm all Godspeed to those guys and girls. But yeah, no, I would not want to be a maker in this day and age. There's a lot on you, because not only do you have to make, you also have to market yourself in an increasingly crowded field of other makers, right?
Yeah, and if you succeed, then before you know of it, you have 10 employees, and then you're the CEO all of a sudden.
Yeah. And historically, we know that's not a recipe for success for a lot of independent makers. A lot of people in the 80s and 90s and even early 2000s, people watches that I really like and whose names are on the dials, whether it's Daniel Roth or Gerald Genter or Peter Spigmarin, or it's a whole bunch of them. They started off making stuff, and then they got, well, there's a lot of excitement about my watches, and let's grow and get more. And all of a sudden you go, well, we can't run a business. Or your investors start dictating what you should do. Let's make blue dials because blue dials are selling well, and like all of that.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a tricky sea to navigate through.
Yeah.
But it's cool. But look, Godspeed to all of them. Sorry, we ended up in a gloomy side of things. We were much more optimistic. Yeah. It's a really interesting, like, I mean, these are kind of the discussions that you and I would have on Instagram, right? We'd send messages going, oh, this is really cool. What a shame that happened to that brand. Or, yeah, so no, this is really good. I like this conversation. One of the questions I was going to ask about, what's the watch collecting vibe down in Denmark? Like, is there like an indie feel? Is it still mostly mainstream? Like, because in my impression of kind of Scandinavian culture is there's a lot more appreciation for handcraft, not just in watches, but in furniture or leather goods or something. There is that kind of known appreciation for that. But that could be completely wrong. That could be the marketing of the Denmark tourism or something. Right?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. I think there's certainly a loosening of the flock mentality or
right.
I think whenever I get to go to Red Bar, it's not as often as I'd like kids, but I can't remember the last time I went home without thinking, I haven't seen that before, or this is something exciting, or learning something about of a new brand. And of course, sometimes it's the same people who brings exciting stuff. But still, there's I think there's actually a pretty broad community with a wide span of what should we say, interest field. Of course, you have Omega collectors, Rolex collectors, and I don't judge anyone. I think it's totally fine.
Sure.
Whatever.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
I've been really excited about both the vintage Rolex and Tudor before, and then so that stuff is cool. For me, it doesn't represent the same amount of interest and enjoyment as it has done before. But Godspeed. but every time I've been to a meetup, I've seen something exciting, and whether being in some kind of new micro brand or last time I went. There was a Sartori Bilard that was totally mind blowing with a mirror dial I think there's lots of great stuff, and also there's been a lot of focus lately on watches in Denmark. A couple of years ago there was a TV program also featuring Christian.
I remember that.
So there's been kind of a resurgence in interest, and there's also a Danish watch podcast, Danish language podcast, and Euroman, which is the big men's magazine, has like a regular watch section and so on. So there's a resurgence in it. I'd say it's a pretty good field of collectors with bringing a broad section of watches every time. So I really enjoy when I get to go. It's a healthy scene, I'd say.
That's great to hear. That's great to hear. And the other brand we probably should have spoken about is Arkanaut. Arkanaut watches. It's a Danish brand. So I've got one of their pieces. I actually lent it to my brother. That's why. Otherwise, that would have been my other choice of wrist candy. Which is really cool because I mean I really like those guys. Like Anders and James at Arkanaut are doing really cool stuff, just both with materials, but really with design as well, which is really really cool. But it is nice to see kind of, because historically I always thought in my mind Danish watchmaking was always like Urban Jürgensen was like the hyper classic but hyper expensive but amazing pieces. And now you're starting to get like Christian, and now you've got Arkanaut. So you're really starting to fill out that ecosystem of watch brands from sort of avant-garde and really interesting use of materials and design all the way up to the classical. So that's always a good thing, because usually if you have an ecosystem of makers, usually you'll get like a little ecosystem of collectors as well around them, sort of thing. But no, that's really cool. A friend of mine, shout out to Jasper at what's his thing? I think it's Jasper the Mechanaut, I think is his thing. Yeah, he's an old friend of mine, an old Instagram friend of mine. I remember he and I used to chat a lot about sort of Danish watches and stuff. And yeah, so it's really cool. It's nice to hear that there's sort of communities gathering, whether it's Red Bar, Copenhagen, or whatever it is. So no, that's really cool. That's really, really cool. So what's the future of the collecting for you? Is it staying time only? Are you moving towards more complications, triple calendars, perpetuals, and minute repeaters, or you're kind of just exploring the world? No plans, flow?
I would say I'd probably stay in the classical realm. I have a triple calendar. I have a Vacheron triple calendar, which I really like. I think it sort of covers my complicated needs.
Sensible man. I like it.
Yeah, just every time I have to wear it, wind it up. Change the month, change the date.
Yeah, that's the painful bit, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm fine by admiring all the complications from afar.
From Instagram.
Exactly.
Good thinking. Yeah. Good thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of maintenance involved in that. Yeah, so no, for me it would probably be trying to as we just talked about, trying to without trying to sound too nasty, find them young and get in early.
That's the dream.
Probably be my strategy going forward.
I think that would be, if anyone's listening to this and thinking about getting into indie watchmaking, yeah, I mean, that's the dream, right? I mean, well, actually, no, it really also depends on your financial means as well. If somebody can leapfrog into, I don't know, Kari Buttalainen or Roger Smith, do it. Sure, absolutely. Yeah. But you're right. Like, the dream is to find the next Kari now, or the next Roger now, and kind of help support their growth and development and stuff. Yeah, that's the dream. Absolutely. Yeah. That's very cool. Alrighty. Well, as we probably start winding down, this is really, I'm really enjoying this conversation. Look, as we start to wind down, one of the things we always do, we try to kind of ask our guests about recommendations, whether it's, you know, Instagram, books, magazines, kind of thing, just to kind of broaden our horizons, and whether it's new makers, new collectors, new books, new drinks, whatever it is. So I might put you on the spot. Is there anything you reckon be worth mentioning or talking about?
There's I've mentioned him before. I think everybody, if they don't follow him already, should go follow my friend Peter at Watch CPH. Yes. Peter's a good friend of mine. He's got an interesting collection. You mentioned before the Hodinkee Burkus piece you saw on my Instagram. That's unfortunately not in my collection. That's
such
Peter's
a good
well.
Watch.
It's amazing.
Such a cool watch.
Amazing.
Yeah. Such a cool maker as well. Such an interesting dude. Like Hodinkee Burkus. Everyone check him out. Such a cool dude.
That could be a recommendation as well. If people haven't listened to Phil Toledano, his Viva Bastardo podcast, he actually has an interview with Andre and I mean, that podcast is just hilarious. It brings a wealth of knowledge, watchmaking wise, and so on and so forth. But most of all, it's just damn funny. I really can't remember the last time I listened to a podcast and literally laughed out loud like 3 or 5 times. So that would be a recommendation for me.
That's awesome, man. That's like 3 recommendations at once. And as it, we'll link up that episode, that Viva Bastardo episode in the show notes. But you're right. It's A, good to listen to because it's just a really interesting insight into Andre Hodinkee Burkus, into his sort of world. But also, yeah, those 2 guys, really good sort of chemistry between them. It is a really funny. It's the perfect kind of podcast. You know, they don't take themselves too seriously, but they do give you a good kind of education about the maker. So that's really cool. No, that's really, really good. Maybe I'll do one as well. Yeah. Mine's not as exciting, but I'll do an Instagram recommendation. So there's an account called A Serial Collector. So A Serial Collector. It's some French dude named Yves. I'm sure I'm saying it wrong. Yves, I presume, is how you say it. Really cool guy. Like, one of my favorite things is kind of hunting down people with really interesting collections who for some reason don't have a lot of followers. And I think this guy, like, just insane collections, about 1,300 followers, like 1,300 followers. And this is a guy who has like an MB&F. There's like an early, we were talking about kind of near vintage Breguet. He's got like a Breguet tourbillon from like the Daniel Roth days. He's also got like the Daniel Roth tourbillon and a Roth perpetual calendar. There's like a Laurent Ferrier. There's a Lane. There's like a Rezepi. This is kind of everything. It's like a dream collection. Like, you sort of go, you couldn't, like, dreams are made of this. Like, how is this guy not on every podcast / talking watches / everything? And you're like, he's got 1,300 followers for some reason. So A Serial Collector, just really cool mix of kind of, not just, but it's all like, so he's got these crazy high watches, but he's also got like a Baltic and a few very reasonable watches as well. So clearly has kind of a good eye for stuff, but just like an insane collection. So it's kind of like dreams are made of. So A Serial Collector, all one word, like highly recommended. If you want to have a few moments of jealousy. Like, well, at least for me, that's like you live through somebody else's, like vicarious. They go like, I don't want to trade anything of mine, but that's kind of cool. I'll take his collection as well.
So you can bathe in your own inferiority before you go to sleep, right?
Totally. Oh, look, Lexi, I don't know about you. Like, I actually, somehow my brain has kind of evolved. Like, I don't sort of have the envy now. Maybe I'm just too kind of jaded, maybe. Like, because I know that there's no end to this craziness. You kind of go, because in my mind, rationally, I sort of go, even if I had his collection, they would still be, the list of watches I would want would still be about the same length, just they would be a lot more expensive, right? Yeah. So I kind of, I don't know if it's the same for you, but I've kind of moved beyond the coveting of other people's watches. I like them, but I'm like, yeah, that's nice. That's not my life.
Exactly. So. I'm totally the same. I'm totally confident and extremely satisfied with what I got. And when you have some pieces that you were part of the process, and I know there will be more on the horizon as well. I totally dwell in that, and I'm really that envy I could experience like 3, 4, 5 years ago, where you're like, oh, I would like to have one of those, and it's just not there anymore, and it's a pleasure to either get the opportunity to handle some of those pieces, to experience it, and I can fully take all the pleasure from that experience, and don't go home and start
crying
that,
your pillow.
start up that spreadsheet in your head where you you sell off part of the house and two of the watches, and downgrade the car, and
you'll have enough for a deposit. Basically, like if I sell everything, and I think as we move, if there's like a parting thought, I think one of the benefits I think of kind of finding and supporting younger makers is that you get to experience the joy at a much lower price bracket. You can still have your custom-made watch that you help design, and whether it's the numerals or the dial or whatever it is, at a reasonable price bracket, whatever that price bracket is, whatever maker you find. But also you feel that you've contributed to somebody's development and investment into the future, just into their kind of future of their craft. Like, yeah, it's absolutely the way to go. That's why indie horology is always the best, right? At least
exactly.
For us.
Exactly. Totally.
Look,
agree.
Man, it's been so fun to have a chat. I'm really glad we could do it. I'm glad, even though we're on the opposite sides of the world, that's just been such a fun conversation. We should definitely do it again. But no, thanks so much.
I'd be more than happy to do it again.
Oh, that's awesome, man. Well, look, the last thing we always say, we'll do the boring bit. We set this up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. So if you're listening to this and you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or even come on a podcast, please get in touch. We don't bite that often. Follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram, or on our website at fifthwrist.com. If you want to join our Slack group, please get in touch. Pretty cool stuff. We actually have Discord as well now. I still don't know how to use it, but we do have one. So to get in touch, it's quite fun, I'm told at least. So like and subscribe to the podcast, you know the drill, leave us a review, all of that. Follow me, I'm at Times Roman AU, and my guest today, Niels, is at Niels MPE, all one word. Thanks for joining us today, and stay on time.